Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 27 for September 2nd. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversation from the previous week. This podcast is designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address podcast@anarchistnews.org. Most stories have more information at the non-sectarian anarchist news site, anarchistnews.org. Editorial. Back to school. It's that time of year again, when students, teachers, professors, and related faculty of workers are returning to school again at the elementary, secondary, and collegiate levels. The day after this Labor Day holiday here in the States, many young and old wild glowing eyes will awaken with excitement, dread, uncertainty, and a thousand other emotions about what this coming school year means to them. A few weeks back, CrimeThink published a topical text about the anarchist relationship to school. It covered the efforts of a small group of anarchists to use collegiate-level student funding to maintain an anarchist group at their university. These kind of creative projects that spring out of the depths of institutions and environments often at odds with the anarchist idea inspire us to take a closer look at those involved. Those coming back from vacation, the place where only dreams can be realized, are witness to the energizing and turbulent situation of Charlottesville and Hurricane Harvey, to name just a few world changers currently unfolding in the American landscape. The university and school are often fleeting events in the life of the student, whirlwinds of those working in such places, and a constant in the life of townies just watching everything pass by. I fondly remember my first introduction to anarchism being around the age 15 and finding an anarchist magazine and quickly trying to absorb and make sense of these particular ideas. Stumbling upon those anarchist ideas and friends at a young age completely changed my life and future relationships. And more than 15 years later, here I am remembering some of the life inside the institutions of school as someone from self-proclaimed Generation Y, or millennial from the early 1980s and into the mid-90s and even early 2000s. I can finally remember being a student in secondary school and absolutely despising almost everything about such a life, except for the friends and relationships made. I heard a podcast the other day about the new so-called iGeneration, or iGen, or roughly adolescents born between 1995 and 2012, or the first generation to spend their entire youth with a smartphone. Some of the same data has previously been covered here and related anarchist podcasts, but it's worth noting again. According to the data, some scholars have determined that the iGen is having less sexual activity, less binge drinking, and physical fights have decreased. So basically, they're having less fun. This same data set also said that the iGen is more depressed, lonelier, less rebellious, and at a greater risk for suicide and self-harm. Teens are spending less time with their friends in real life and tend to spend their leisure time in fundamentally different ways than before. Accordingly, social media and cell phones seem to be one of the issues related, be it causally or correlated, and a reflection of the much deeper problem of capitalism and the state. The podcast goes on to say that many in iGen spend a great deal of the day enveloped on a screen with limited face-to-face interactions, while these face-to-face interactions that are missing are often linked to a better mental health. Sound familiar? As Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, put it recently, sometimes the very technology that is meant to connect us divides us. On the other side of things, the iGeneration tends to be less religious, less spiritual, and less likely to believe in a god or gods. On the political spectrum, and possibly most interesting for anarchists, is that iGens tend to be more politically independent, have no party affiliation, an individualistic approach to culture with a focus on the self, and appear to be very liberal on social issues, yet more conservative in other areas like gun control. At base, they are libertarians. However, according to the data, with this political approach comes a stronger work ethic than previous generations, possibly out of fear and vulnerability, with a lack of taking action towards their beliefs, related perhaps to their low level of optimism. Damn, kids these days. So basically, smartphones have ruined a generation of youth, and it was not everything else, like student loan debt and the changing job market. Well, whatever it is, iGen has become known as a generation of thinking without consequences. People thinking more along computational lines and the rise of artificial intelligence. We are looking at the effects of technology and a child's brain development, the dopamine levels, the screens everywhere one looks, and often the resulting deprivation and lack of sleep. iGeneration is being characterized as more vulnerable, having a stronger desire for validation and need for instantaneous feedback via the ubiquitous social media and connected apparatuses. While data is just data, and the question of such overarching generalities, please don't generalize, it does hold up with some personal experience. The idea inside and outside of many education circles today is that technology can save us. These unknown places to go, and here we see data sets about what is going on with the youth today. Science and the race of the state and capital to be all, certainly a dark but intriguing thought experiment. Back to school, work, play, whatever it is you're doing. One can find inspiration in encountering anarchist ideas and practice in the unknown places of everyday life outside of the weeknight, weekend, vacation. Outside of that and everything else, to a time of everything, maybe what's happening is that we're all becoming children again. Our rigid roles and characters are dropping off like dried skin. We're fascinating to each other because each one of our acts might be a total surprise. At any instant, our personalities might change completely. Like children, we're not exhausted by what we have been and are. Life is ahead of us. We're no longer dead.
What's new this week? In response to the Religion of Green Anarchy, MontrealCounterInfo.org provides this article responding to a previous one called The Religion of Green Anarchy. It is critical, but friendly. The responding author seems to think that Montreal CounterInfo was the source of the initial article, which is not the case. For those who have been around for a while, the response piece is an exercise in pointing out how the voices of primitivism have shifted over the years, as some people have left the publishing scene and others have moved in. The unnamed author of this response cites quotations from the old Green Anarchy magazine, which was closely associated with but not produced by John Zerzan, as well as some brief citations of Zerzan, one rhetorical question and one title of a book, from a past that does not reflect Zerzan's output at this point. Ultimately, it is good to see critical conversations on these topics, and we hope they get better and better. The commentary on this thread is fairly interesting, though nothing is pursued for very long or in great depth. I'm actually quoting from someone's rebuttal to the author here. Quote, quoting the author, which brings me to my last point, the statement, even if we return to hunter-gatherer lifestyles, capitalism and domination would continue. Well, okay, I'm sorry, but that is just not true. A news commenter. Here, the original author's statement is being treated as theoretical when it is in fact practical. Theoretically, if everyone suddenly was a full-fledged hunter-gatherer, sure, they would not also suddenly be able to create capitalism again. In practice, people trying to transfer from civilization into hunter-gatherer bands would be ridiculously messy, with many resisting and trying to keep or recreate capitalism with whatever infrastructure remained at the time, and half the ones who tried out hunting-gathering would get burnt out after a few weeks. Unquote.
Anarchism and Solidarity, Thoughts on Out-Organizing Capitalism Without the State. From itsasocialconstruct.wordpress.com, which says about itself, quote, it's a social construct attempts to be a playful and refreshing source of critiques on aspects of life, mainly in cultural, political, and social developments. We attempt to describe and deconstruct processes that go unchallenged or forgotten in the hopes that we can change it, unquote. This is a blog piece on the power of coordinated people. It cites the Greeks, the Spanish Civil War, and the Zapatistas, and encourages anarchists to do work in communities. Quote, so an anarchist city wouldn't go into another area because that wouldn't make sense. What they would mostly do is appeal to the people who do not desire the state and offer solidarity to strengthen ties between these communities. It is possible that a state may appear again, but with a fractured people between each other, as well as organized collectives. The state would most likely not have power to begin forcing itself into communities again. After all, the real source of power is organized people, but under what ideal is always at contention. Like I mentioned originally in the past, anarchists do not believe in a vacuum of power, but in a dispersal of power throughout the people as much as possible. Unquote.
Germany, in a first, shuts down left-wing extremist website. From the New York Times, Linksunden.indymedia has been shut down. Quote, Linksunden Indymedia, founded in 2008, billed itself as a weapon in the social struggle and said it was a decentralized, organized global network of social movements. The ministry was able to move against the website because it viewed those running it as an association, and under German law, those can be blocked for extremist activity. The platform was not accessible on Friday, and the ministry said that its goal was to shut the site permanently. Unquote.
Not all anarchists are violent. From a letter to the editor of the Washington Post, this is a brief letter pointing out that anarchists are shown as violent for the purposes of selling media products. If the letter hadn't gone any further than that, it would have been fine. Quote, anarchism has had its apostles of violence, as have Republicans, Democrats, monarchists, and socialists. But in the main, anarchism has espoused and practiced peace. Unquote.
Under no circumstances will I ever cooperate. From the Earth First Newswire, Jaden Savino is being harassed by the FBI and delineates what that means, giving people useful information on what to expect if and when it happens to us. There are also links to information sources. We always appreciate accounts of how our enemies attack us and how we resist them. Quote, we have nothing to gain and much of our freedom to lose from cooperating with the FBI. If an FBI agent contacts you, do not speak to them. Remember, law enforcement officers are trained to lie to us and to manipulate individuals into responding to questions in ways that can be used to justify criminal charges of lying to a federal agent. Those charges, which carry a 5-year prison penalty all on their own, are then used as leverage to coerce further cooperation and damage our communities. It is therefore safest not to answer any of their questions. If an agent comes to your home, do not answer the door. Ask them to leave their card at the door and to leave, and contact an attorney immediately. If you have been contacted by law enforcement and would like to spread the word to keep your community aware and safe, or if you have questions about FBI harassment of activists, you can contact the Earth First Journal at collective@earthfirstjournal.org. Unquote. Best of luck to Jaden, of course.
Not your grandfather's anti-fascism. From CrimeThink. CrimeThink consistently puts out thoughtful, informative, topical pieces, which is a real challenge. Quibbles with some of their conclusions aside, it's unclear to this attendee how many more people were there on Sunday because of the murder in Charlottesville, for example. This piece does a good job of deconstructing media coverage by mainstream media sources and giving historical context. Quote, ultimately, a thoroughgoing anti-fascist movement should not focus on targeting fascist groups that are so marginal that they stick out from the rest of the political spectrum, but take on the infrastructure through which any authoritarian program will be enacted. That is to say, it should focus on the state itself. If we simply fight defensive battles, the fascists will eventually gain the initiative. We should take the experiences of fighting together that can experience in an anti-fascist struggle and use those as points of departure to work together to solve all the problems that we have. This is the way to take the offensive and move on to confronting the fundamental sources of oppression. Unquote. This is another thread with some solid commentary from Anonymous.
Not our comrades. ITS attacks on anarchists. Another IGD piece by Scott Campbell that explains that ITS is bad and that assumes that everything that LBC, Aragorn, and Anarchist News does is in bad faith, as if proving one proves the other. Campbell gives more backstory on some actions that ITS claims or is assumed to have done, but ignores or impugns explicit criticisms and distancing that has happened in the projects that he names as occluding with ITS. And the question of what does, quote, providing a platform, unquote, mean in either practice or theory is never addressed. Quote, this is pointed out not with the expectation that these individuals and projects will stop supporting ITS. Rather, it is so anarchists are aware of those in our circles who are providing legitimacy and cover for a group whose sole purpose is to murder people and who have a history of targeting anarchists in particular. ITS has proclaimed itself an enemy to anarchists. Its words and deeds reaffirm that. Why, then, should our enemies be welcome or tolerated in our spaces? Unquote. This is a call-out for violence against people Campbell disagrees with.
Insult and injury, ideas and actions, an anarchist defense of unlimited freedom of expression. From bad-press.net, a piece from 1994 that Peacock is republishing, as it, quote, remains particularly relevant today, unquote. In these days of active resistance to outrageous white supremacists, free speech is under attack, not usually backed up by particularly articulate or articulated theory, but with obvious justification. This piece attempts to defend one of the most liberal of all premises from an anarchist perspective. Quote, the way to respond to ideas with which one disagrees is to propagate different ideas. Open debate of opposing ideas is the best method of finding the truth and promoting ethical philosophies. Only those who fear that they will lose in such a debate advocate that the views of their opponent should be suppressed. Those who advocate a new kind of society where people live in freedom, but feel it is necessary to suppress the ideas of others in order to achieve this new world, might benefit from a look back at the history of the Soviet Union, where exactly such a philosophy was implemented. As an early critic of the Leninists said, quote, freedom is always and exclusively freedom for the one who thinks differently, unquote.
Everywhere a Battlefield, submitted by Anonymous, subtitled Martial Discipline and the Cultural Sphere, Imperialist Crisis, Rising Fascism, and Widespread Heroin Epidemics. This piece is long, and one Anonymous says that they posted it for the lulls, which were not delivered. It picks some historical cherries, quotations by Stalin, for example, and says that there are parts of fascist analysis that are correct, that culture is a site of struggle slash war. Mostly, this is a slightly more complicated call to arms of the sort that times of rioting and street confrontations frequently inspire. Quote, culturally, the working class upholds symbols of physical prowess, with sportswear almost ubiquitous in working class closets. We might not even have our Sunday best, but you can bet that we have tracksuits, sneakers, gym shorts, and hooded sweatshirts. Even the t-shirt itself was a working class staple adopted from the military before it was appropriated by other classes. The elitist urban middle class turns its nose up at every bit of proletarian culture until, of course, they decide to appropriate it for themselves and then exclude the working class from it. And this produces understandable class hatred toward them, and rural working class Americans are not wrong when they identify the wealthy sections of urban populations not only as outsiders, but as antagonistic ones. Unquote.
August 29th, not June 29th, multi-city coordinated banner drop, Abolish America. Quote, we hope to inspire actions that recognize America as a white supremacist establishment deserving of the same destructive abolition as any white supremacist organization. When burning Confederate flags, why stop there? American flags are everywhere around us, reflecting a genocidal history justified by white supremacy. Every institution we frequent for work, education, and resources is monumental in reinforcing the values of colonial white supremacy. In every city and state, these monuments and statues litter parks and financial districts. The opportunity for direct action is everywhere around us. We refuse to participate in validating their spectacle of peaceful denial. We don't want to waste time attempting to captivate this historical opportunity to organize the masses. As individuals, we hope these small coordinated actions inspire a wildfire of realized insurrectionary potential in others. We don't want nor need political parties or organizations to lead us. We won't water down our ideas for mainstream media consumption. We really do want to destroy America. Unquote.
Crass, capitalist traitors using copyright laws against anarchopunk.net, 3,000 albums deleted because of these greedy, selfish sellout bastards. What happens when an idealistic band breaks up and the less idealistic members keep using the name? One option is the sequence of events told in this story. Quote, Crass could have simply contacted anarchopunk.net and asked us to remove their albums. A friendly agreement could easily have been made and their albums would have been removed in less than 24 hours. It's clearly written on our website that anarchopunk.net will remove any album if the band or the label asks. The moderators have done this many times during the past. Instead of doing that, Krauss preferred to use the capitalist system and its laws against anarchists who are supposed to be their comrades, unquote. This thread is pretty punk itself, though, so that's sweet.
Why do we publish such objectionable things? From littleblackcart.com, this is a response to the new piece by Scott Campbell. Among other things, it attempts to explain that publishing books doesn't mean supporting all the perspectives included in those books. The thread is lively and includes some interesting perspectives as well as some knee-jerk responses. Quote, anarchism has failed a lot of people. We have written and published about this failure since the Occupy movement sparked and sputtered, but it's worth restating as a frame for thinking about critiques of anarchism today. Anarchism has always been an idea too big for itself, with a grasp that far exceeds its reach, and that's hard to swallow when there is such desperate need. This world is tearing people apart, from environmental destruction to all kinds of diminishing returns in late capitalism, to the rise of nationalism in the U.S. and around the world, but our role, as we see it, is to play the long game. We accept a failure of anarchism while remaining anarchists ourselves. One of our responses to the horrible conditions of this world is to underpromise what we are capable of. This makes us the target of those who believe anarchists should deliver the new world out of this decaying shell. We wish them well and frankly would benefit from their apocalyptic vision comes true, but our work is not the same as theirs. Unquote.
Responding to Antifa and Rise Up on Revolutionary Politics and Nonviolence. From counterpunch.org, a non-anarchist leftist call for dialogue, nonviolence, because violence, quote, provides the state with an excuse, unquote, fucking lol, and against anonymity. The piece does decry some of the inadequate rhetorical devices in common usage today, but it doesn't really matter because who wants to talk to this guy anyway? Quote, the "you're just a liberal and that's bad" line on the far left is a shop-worn cliche, and it suggests a failure of left radicals to cultivate mass support for change. It reveals how off the mark those who engage in such condemnations are regarding larger efforts at mass movement building. The left of contemporary 2017 America is deeply divided and fractured, and it is a shadow of its former self, considering the decline of organized labor and the disappearance of left public intellectuals in higher education. In this environment, what remains of the left desperately needs to reach out to the masses of Americans, including liberals, moderates, and political independents, and to pull them further to the left if there is to be any chance of meaningful change. And berating anyone who is not perceived to be on the far left, rather than patiently working to bring these individuals into a broader left movement, is a recipe for irrelevance. No substantive political change will ever be achieved with small groups of vanguard leftists shouting in condemnation against those who are not hardcore enough in their politics. Unquote.
Regarding the 13 years of prison to Iriana, Greece. From 325.nostate.org, this is a detailed account of another sad and alarming story of prosecution, this time against the partner of someone who was found innocent, written by the partner who was found innocent. Quote, Iriana was sentenced as a member of the CCF because she got a relation with me. But according to their tribunals, I'm not a member of their organization, that is, not a member of CCF. Unquote. For those of us following the ever-changing tactics of the state, here is yet another example worth noting.
Anarchy in the Jewish State. From the Jewish mainstream site, the Jerusalem Post, this story is from last year, but we finally found it. It includes some inspirational personal stories and some relevant context. Quote, the anarchist movement in Israel is very small, even for an already small country. Past estimates have put their total number at 300 or so, but I'd estimate the number to be significantly higher based on the fact that I saw at least 100 people turn out for a unity rally in Haifa on a recent afternoon. Still, the anarchist movement has not caught on in Israel the way it has in other parts of the world. Part of the reason is because the state has such a monopoly over the means of violence and is so well equipped to handle popular unrest, says Yossi Shein, a political philosophy professor at Tel Aviv University. These types of anarchist groups, like Unity, are incredibly marginal, he tells the report, explaining that the military strength of the government naturally inhibits such behavior. Anarchism may also be unattractive to Israelis because to dissolve the country's borders, which are considered vital for national security and are often seen as a bulwark against Islamic extremism, may seem a rather daunting task to the average layman. An Israeli restaurant worker and activist named Anne, who self-identifies as an anarchist, says it could be totally paralyzing to consider how difficult that task is, unquote. The article is typical of the category of mainstream coverage that says that anarchists are well-intentioned but naive. Nobody gets to say that about anarchists but other anarchists.
Podcasts. Anarchy Radio from 8/29/2017. An hour. Harvey Water is warm, which makes things worse. Southern pine beetle. Ice disappearing. Shootings. Chomsky makes Jay-Z happy. Chisel continues to be postmodern and subjective. Jay-Z speaks truth, doesn't call names, and demonstrates that he doesn't recognize substance when it's speaking his name. Toxic mist in Monterey Bay. Homeless children in New York City. Mazda recall. Positive experience for Cliff at Seattle Book Fair. Jay-Z decries Zapatista move to politics. Ads for black and green products. EU survey finds that more than half of millennials say they would protest generation of power. Mostly European and Canadian action reports. Car burnings, heavy equipment sabotage, pipeline attacks, electricity, fish farms occupied, anti-oil field occupation, mink release, fascists chased away, ununion strike against Target, tech report. Largest indoor water park. Maternal death rates doubled from late 1980s. Syphilis rates up. Google line kills nearby folks. Robot teachers. Hackers crack safes. Letter from tech lords to ban lethal robots, etc.
The Final Straw Radio interview with Elisa of Sao Paulo Indie Media with A Radio Berlin, an hour long. This is an interview from A Radio Berlin with one of the co-founders of Brazil's Indie Media, a very early indie media project. The interview is from June 2017, and the Final Straw airs it now because of the recent shutdown in Germany of a website for being allegedly part of the Hamburg resistance organizing. Sean starts at about 8:15. He discusses strategy for fighting racism and is critical of what most anti-racists do. He has a nuanced analysis that makes sense from someone who has actual experience with people who are racist, among other things. Sean is always worth listening to, even when he refers to the marketplace of ideas, and that's saying something. The interview starts at about 15 minutes in. It talks about the history and development of the Sao Paulo Indie Media, started in 2001, a brief explanation of what is going on in Brazil politically, the response of the left to having a president that is supposed to be left, spoiler alert, presidents are not liberatory. Germans interviewing Brazilians in English is a treat that we English speakers should appreciate.
Free Radical Radio audiobooks. They Who Marry Do Ill by Voltairine de Cleyre. This episode of Free Radical Radio features one of my favorite of de Cleyre's essays. It is an example of arguing against the strongest part of an opposing argument rather than the weakest, a lesson I try to keep in mind in my conflicts and fail at too frequently. If you have not listened to or read this essay, I encourage you to do so. Rydra's commentary includes this. Quote, "Perhaps the most important aspect of this essay, though, is its understanding of another often ignored cliché, that people change." Voltairine writes, quote, "Bodies, like souls, do most seldom, almost never, parallel each other's development. And this lack of parallelism is the greatest argument to be produced against marriage. No matter how perfectly adapted to each other two people may be at a given time, it is not the slightest evidence that they will continue to be so." Unquote. These words again strike at the religious nature of anarchists. It attacks the notion of fixed ideas and stasis. Voltairine acknowledges that hopefully humans change ideas, bodies, and desires over time, and that it is rare for these desires to closely parallel enough for long-term close communion. Many anarchists believe they have found answers, believing that they are on a path with a destination instead of an endless journey. If we can admit this to ourselves and open our bodies and minds to the notion of fluidity and change, then we can change the way we orient ourselves in our personal relationships. Unquote.
Hotwire, Episode 1, 34 minutes, from the ex-worker, a.k.a. Crime Think. Mislisted as Episode 2, this is actually the first of this new weekly show. It includes an interview with Scott Crowe, famous from Common Ground, an anarchist response to Hurricane Katrina, who is now going to support people surviving Hurricane Harvey. Apparently, ex-Common Grounders and Antifa folks are also working to help survivors, as well as some members of Redneck Revolt. The Hotwire also talks about European actions, poetry, responses to Charlottesville, their quotes from IGD, speaks with a Bay Area anarchist anti-fascist about the Sunday action in Berkeley, and with a participant of an ongoing action in Chapel Hill, with info about Katie Yao and Jaden Savino, who continue to refuse to testify, and the J20 resistors. It ends with political prisoner birthdays and some upcoming events. I really look forward to Rebel Girl reading with a bit more shifts in tempo.
A Radio, report back from Charlottesville, Unite the Right and the Murder of Heather Hare. 33 minutes. This is A Radio's interview of William Goodenough, one of the two people who are the Final Straw Project, and who was on the street during the event in Charlottesville. William talks about different groups on the white supremacy side and what they say during the attack by car, gun culture, and militarized police forces, among other things.
Topic of the week, solidarity across borders. Rojava, Palestine, Chiapas. All of these are household names among leftists as beacons of struggle against oppression by the dispossessed of the world. Though frameworks like anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism may be more prevalent among socialists, these and other struggles have continued to attract the interest and support of anarchists in Europe, the US, and elsewhere as well. Whether driven by the desire to help people resisting oppression by malevolent forces in this world, or the chance to help build something which looks like anarchy in our lifetime, anarchists performing international solidarity are carrying on a tradition that's lived as long as the idea itself. Yet if a concept of international solidarity forms a common point between anarchists and a broader left, so too do many of the troubling aspects that come with it. The role of the partisan seems to lend itself to a degree of idealism, even among those who claim to engage in critical support. There is also a risk that, as in many conflicts where anarchists engage with organizing and mainstream politics, we are participating with a degree of political naivete which ignores the larger forces at work around us and who stand to benefit from the world which we are helping to build. What is your concept of international solidarity? How do you engage in it? Or if you don't, why?
Yeah, this is a hard question. I remember 5 years ago or so, I spent some serious time in Europe, and I came home and I felt like I had a very clear vision of what international solidarity was. You know, I felt like I had people who I was visualizing when I was thinking about their stories and how to help publish them and think about them and help them out with their projects. And as it's been longer for me to have been traveling myself, it feels like the amount of solidarity work I do is much less. And I think that it's fair to say that the people who are the best known and the best advocates for other places and for doing solidarity work for other places tend to be people who travel a lot. And even if when we think back to, you know, anarchist history in the 19th century, you know, by and large, the Emmas and Bakunins and Kropotkins of the world were buzzing around Europe like crazy.
Yeah.
They, as a very central part of their lives, was travel.
Right.
Was being exiled from the places that they were at, was moving from place to place. And I think that especially, I mean, it's hard to know what it meant to travel in the same way that it, you know, that we know what it means to travel today, because today, if you're a traveler, it tends to mean that you either have no commitments and some sort of disposable income, or perhaps you're an economic refugee, or I don't know. And to me, that really informs the conversation about what does international solidarity look like, because by and large, I think in this world, it seems like helping out economic refugees or political refugees, i.e. from Syria, is sort of the best definition I can think of. Whereas the people who sort of seem to be traveling and doing international solidarity in the context of their travels tend to be in a different category altogether, one that in most circumstances we're critical of.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about it in terms of framing it as by travel. I do think that you're right that it's hard to have solidarity, which is a word I'm just going to let stand on its own at the moment, without having a relationship to the context that people are talking about. At least it is for me, because it's nothing is ever as simple as the story that somebody tells. And I, as an anarchist, want to, when I hear stories of people engaging in these struggles with forces that are greater than themselves, you know, want to, you know, throw the fist of solidarity up and say, yeah, you know, go ahead, right on. But I'm not sure if that feels like an empty gesture to me. And being able to paying lip service to someone throwing their lives and their body at a problem
especially when you are 3,000 miles, 5,000 miles, 8,000 miles away from that problem. There's something in there that feels disrespectful to me to say that I'm helping you do this thing. And by helping you do this thing, I'm doing it from the comfort of my couch. And because I don't travel like that, and I'm not a person of international experience, at least not politically for sure. I don't have any other way to engage with these things. And so then I don't, for lack of creativity, time, I'm not entirely sure what. So I certainly don't have the relationship to these things that I would like to have, but I'm not sure that I have a good framing for what a good relationship is or what actual solidarity looks like when you are so far removed from the culture and the politics and the geography, and all of those things really matter in these conflicts.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have stopped saying things like solidarity means attack, which was another sort of popular approach to this from an anarchist perspective a couple years ago. You know, so as an example, Syria and Rojava, you know, would have been in a different time places where people really could have like taken targets that were local targets and attacked them. So, you know, it could have been as simple as investigating which American military companies are involved in bombing something. You know, it could have been as simple as getting involved in Russia stuff or anti-Russia stuff, as the case may be. Like there still is that you know, it's not direct solidarity. It's not even necessarily indirect solidarity, but it is the solidarity of affect, I guess.
The solidarity of affect. You were in Europe. Did you have these conversations with people? Do you have a sense that the solidarity of affect is meaningful when it comes over the internet, from across the Atlantic, from the other side of the world?
Well, I think, yeah. The impression that I got from anarchists in Europe that were paying attention to international affairs was that they were very thankful for there to be news of people, that there was a kind of dialogue that did happen via the internet and via our you know, very quick news sources. So, you know, people who are associated with the Contra Info Project were paying attention to what was happening at Anarchist News. And I'm sure nowadays, you know, IGD, which is sort of the better reflection of solidarity type actions,
sure,
that there's plenty of people in Europe who are looking at that and saying, okay, that, you know, I'm going to pay attention to if there's some communique from a group that does this or that.
So posting people's stories, posting the news stories, posting communiques from these groups that are involved in these things does feel like some act of support to people who might actually be on the ground and in these things, because at least we're talking about, we're paying attention to the thing that they're doing.
Well, it's hard to say, because the people who are paying attention to international affairs are not necessarily the people who are the ones being solidarity, like they're not necessarily the people you're doing solidarity with. So let's say, for instance, there's a group of people being repressed in England. Mm-hmm. You know, the person that's paying attention to the international stuff is in Holland. That obviously is sort of different. So you know, like a lot of other examples, it could be that, I hate to minimize it with this. So I guess I'll just limit it to say that I think that there is some appreciation of that level of internationalism. And perhaps that's a level beyond just sitting on your couch and saying solidarity. But what would a bigger step, like what would something more meaningful look like? That to me is a pretty open question.
Yes. Yeah. A question that I don't have a good answer to. When I lived in New York, I remember going to a couple protests at embassies to support what was going on in Greece. Mm-hmm. And so it meant that there were write-ups and pictures and people talking about it on Facebook and talking about it on Twitter. You know, we went to the embassy, you know, 50 people standing in the street, chanting and protesting, and in the moment, being there, the act itself actually seemed fairly silly. Mm-hmm. the New York City Police Department is incredibly large. And usually 50 people standing randomly in one place at one time is enough to get their attention. And we were not. And we were by an embassy. There was an embassy security guard who was watching us and didn't really seem to care about us. And it just didn't seem like it mattered to anyone that we were there.
Were you in New York when the arson attempt happened against an embassy? I can't remember if it was the Greek embassy or not.
I don't remember. But it seemed to me that afterwards, it might have been more important that we were there and then it could be talked about the fact that we were there than what was actually happening, why we were there. Because then it went up on the internet and in the world, and then other people started to interact with it. And I was pointed to a comment from someone in Greece who, you know, whose basically response was, yay, awesome, comrades showing up and supporting us. And I was surprised by that reaction, but I don't know really where I'm going with that. Maybe it's much more perception than it is actually the action when you're that far away. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, the flip side of that is the critique we make of a lot of things, which is that feels like a ritualistic activity.
Sure.
And is sort of classic of the kind of liberalism that most anarchists, myself included, am pretty hostile towards.
Yeah. No, I agree. I went as the favor to a friend. And when I was there, I was reminded why, all right, this is why I don't do this. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm not sure. When you just don't know more, it's hard to have a relationship with these things, both supportive or critical. And it's also impossible not to look at everything through the lens of being an American. And so often that's not appropriate at all.
Sure.
But, you know, how do you undo that when this is where you've been?
Yeah, it seems like we've come a long way in the sense that, you know, very few anarchists wouldn't agree that having a sort of internationalist perspective is important and that, you know, we share struggle and all the rest. But I think that more than ever, you know, the internet is the best lever we have to engage in something international without devoting a lot of resources and a lifestyle to being involved in other people's spaces and whatnot.
Sure.
And I'm just not sure how to sort of categorize that as like anarchists should do this.
Right.
Because I'm not sure even doing symbolic activities that can be shared on the internet is enough. I mean, it's definitely not enough, but I'm not even sure it's something I would advocate for.
Right. No, I don't know. And I feel like, you know, I'm not sure. Yeah, I don't know what I would advocate for, other than, you know, paying attention and, you know, for us to keep talking about it. And it would be.
Well, what do you think we should be talking about more that's happening somewhere else? There's a current court case with the Mapuche in Chile. There's ongoing situation in Syria with the Kurds. There's continuing austerity in Greece.
I would love to have what I feel like is good, reliable information about Syria, for sure. I have a sense that there's a lot of complication and layers to that conflict, and I would like to understand it better. I always hope that somewhere in there are lessons for American anarchists. I don't know if that's true in this situation. But I would like to hear better, not mainstream stories about what's going on there. It's caught my attention anyway.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
International, no, I'm universal, but you a gangster. How you get to do commercials with them big wigs? Yeah, cause you do it big. I stay real, stay sharp, and tell it like it is. I never fake
the weekly Anarchy 101 question and some answers. In this segment, we take questions and some of the answers and responses from the website anarchy101.org, a user-moderated Q&A site for anarchists to answer questions on anarchist thought and activity. Most questions on the site have a lot of commentary that we don't read, but is certainly at least half the fun. The question this week is, what do you think of consent as a basis for anarchist relations, or seduction? The full question, whether from the influence of feminism or otherwise, do unto others only what they would have you do unto them, has become one of the most accepted anarchist principles, and not only in sexual matters. Some anarchists, however, have critiqued consent for its reinforcement of safety zones that they say anarchy is about breaking out of. The text Terror Incognita, for example, points to the scarier space of seduction as ripe for anarchist practice. What do you think? Answer number one. Here are some thoughts. A. If consent is defined, understood as conscious and explicit permission to engage in a particular act or interaction, then it gives too much power to consciousness and verbal clarity. Our consciousnesses are, I would argue, a small fraction of how we interact with the world, and are, perhaps, the most easily controlled and manipulated. I'm not sure I agree with that, but I'll leave it there anyway. Communication is confusing even when nothing serious is on the line, and we've known someone for years. B. If consent is understood as either explicit or tacit going along with, then it is so open that it becomes useless as an idea. People who rely on consent as a way to address power dynamics, lack of self-defense information and or techniques, and confusing cultural differences are all emphasizing A. But that option assumes that everyone is weak and needing protection. It assumes fragility and emphasizes danger. It seems related to the social stereotypes of overprotection, from everything being marketed as antibiotic to parents being prosecuted if they dare to allow their children out of their sight. I'm trying to stay open to how it might still be useful, and the best I can do is consider that these terms are not that different from other political jargon that has come before, that it is just a new language that people will learn to maneuver and negotiate through, and that really may be the case. Not sure this is addressing the actual question. Answer number two. I think it becomes easier to think about this question when the subject is a venue. We live in a society that is theoretically divided into different zones with different rules for those zones. Those rules are based on who may wind up there. The granularity can be modulated with planned events in those venue zones. I expect to be the subject of seduction on ultra sex night at the sex bar in the sex district. That isn't a bad idea. Anarchists may be into breaking the rules of zones created for a general domination by blank. However, I don't think this is meant as a question about how much consent we ought to be given by our enemies to destroy them. I have a problem with the safe space concept, but not because in its attempt to create a space with expected interactions. I think it's just another buzzword that fits into a liberal activist lexicon, and that it's often doublespeak for the regulation of a space by a politics of privilege analysis. Next answer. In one of Rilke's biographies, it's said that the reason he, Rilke, was so attractive to women was not due to any effect that his person or manners had on them, but because he was so evidently in love with them. The women he formed relationships with were always taken with the fact that they had affected him so strongly. I.e., it seems to me that if you think about it very much, seduction doesn't make much sense at all as a way of interacting with human beings who you respect or love. You might wish that they would love you in return, but I think you realize this is something you can never ask for or expect, because if you did love them, really, then you understand that this emotion is too delicate to have been produced by any technique, testing of boundaries, or other form of experiment. So, ixnated seduction. As always, if you don't like these answers or have your own question to ask, visit anarchy101.org and join the conversation.
I don't want to do it.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, this podcast was sound edited by Lynn O'Mabel, written by Jackie, editorial was written by One of the Collective, narrated by Chisel and a Friend. Thanks to Aragorn and Ariel for their help with the topic of the week. Contact us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, books, pamphlets, and other anarchist material are available at littleblackcart.com, and news and up-to-the-minute commentary, obviously, at anarchistnews.org.
Do it.